Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. We continue with the full bio series, President Carter's foreign policy. There were historic highs like the 1978 Camp David Accord, secretly negotiated over 12 days, with Carter himself mediating the terms set by Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Then there were the lows, the hostage crisis of 1979, after Carter allowed the deposed Shah of Iran into the U.S. for cancer treatment. Carter okayed a secret rescue mission that failed, and later this hour we'll hear from someone who was part of that rescue team. Those two events defined Carter's foreign policy legacy, but were not the totality of it, and this is where we pick up with Jonathan Alter. Let's talk about foreign policy. It seems that human rights were at the center of President Carter's decision-making around foreign policy. You write in the book, Carter signaled to dictators that the old days of exporting their raw materials to America in exchange for a blind eye to their abuses of power were over. Understandably, as a man of faith and of having a moral compass, this makes sense. Why did he think this was good for America and Americans?
Because it was in the tradition of our highest ideals, however often we fell short of them. And Carter himself fell short in that sense. The human rights policy was hypocritical at times. You know, he supported the Shah of Iran. He supported Marcos in the Philippines. But overall, it was not only one of his most important accomplishments, but one of the most important accomplishments of any president in the 20th century. And there's a Harvard professor named Carl Deutsch, a very distinguished professor of international relations, who ran into Carter at Emory in Atlanta after Carter was defeated and Carter was kind of depressed. And this professor said to him, you know, President Carter, 1,000 years from now, very few American presidents will be remembered, but yours will be one of them because you were the first leader anywhere in the world who set a global standard for how other governments should treat their own people. Before that, it was basically nobody's business. Hmm. Even where he fell short, he set this standard, which endures to this day. Even you know, Carter, for instance, established an Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, who was this wonderful woman named Pat Derrion, who terrified dictators. and you know, even though Trump didn't even fill that position, and has reneged on all sorts of human rights commitments, that standard is still there. And what was interesting to me was looking at what conservatives said after Carter left the White House. Conservatives who had thought Carter's human rights policy was naive, and they, you know, they thought it was hurting us in the Cold War. They found out from people like Vaclav Havel and others, it actually helped us immensely in the Cold War, because soft power is so important. So people like Vaclav Havel, who was in prison in Czechoslovakia, or Lech Walesa in Poland, they took enormous encouragement from the idea that there was this human rights policy in the United States. And then, you know, Sakharov and Sharansky in the Soviet Union, in his first days in office, Carter is challenging the Soviet government on the way they treat dissidents and getting dissidents freed. And then in Latin America, his standing up to dictators there and telling them that they were jeopardizing support that they got from the United States led over a period of 10 to 15 years to a dramatic transformation from dictatorship to democracy in almost every Latin American country. And does Carter alone deserve all the credit for that? No. If you look at somebody like Kim Dae-jung in South Korea, who was in prison when Carter was president, when he was elected president of South Korea some years later, and Carter's assistant secretary for human rights, Patricia Darian, went to his swearing in, and she and the new president of South Korea said, "You know, if it wasn't for you and President Carter, I'd be dead." Not to mention not president of South Korea, you know. And so even though Carter himself felt like the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and other issues in the last 2 years of his presidency made his policy disappointing, I think in later years he recognized that human rights was central to his legacy. And they're really, I mean, I'm hoping that other historians look into this, because there's been surprisingly little scholarship on it, but it stands up very well to scrutiny, and I think over time appreciation of what Carter did on human rights is growing.
Transparency and honesty were very important to President Carter, but he didn't make choices about what should be concealed. And you're right that the two biggest secrets of his administration were establishing diplomatic relations with China and the B-2 stealth bomber. What determined to him whether or not something should be held in secret?
Well, I think he realized that diplomacy is really hard to do in public. So a lot of reporters had their noses out of joint when he barred them from Camp David, when he was, you know, pulling off this miraculous peace deal between Israel and Egypt in 1978. And he felt the same way about normalizing relations with China. There was such opposition to that among conservatives that he felt if word had leaked out that we were changing this policy and that we were going to basically abandon what had been this completely unworkable to China policy, where we, you know, had relations with both mainland China and Taiwan, you know, or had, well, we still have relations with both, but that we, you know, could manage that kind of to China policy was untenable. And as he moved away from that and established this relationship with Deng Xiaoping, that basically is the foundation of today's global economy, the bilateral relationship between the United States and China, that it, a lot of it had to be done in secret, in the same way that Nixon first opened the door to China in secret in 1971 and 72. So by 78 and 79, it was still necessary to operate in secret and to use Zbigniew Brzezinski as national security advisor to begin those negotiations, although Carter himself was deeply involved in the secret talks that led to the full diplomatic relations. And you have to remember that at that time, China had a GDP that of a sub-Saharan African mm-hmm. country. And after normalization, Carter one night was awakened in the middle of the night by a call from China, and his science advisor was there, and he, you know, Carter thought, why are they bugging me in the middle of the night? Is there some sort of, you know, volcano like Mount St. Helens or something? You know, and he told the story to me, you know, his science advisor, Frank Press, says, "Well, I'm sitting here with Deng Xiaoping, who is one of the most important leaders in the history of China. And he wants to send 10,000 students to the United States." At that time, I think they sent about 50. And Carter is annoyed. He says, "Tell him he can send 100,000 for all I care." He's being kind of facetious. He gets off the phone. Well, today there are 250,000 Chinese students who study in the United States. They're keeping a number of American colleges mm-hmm. afloat. There's so many other things like that that are the product of this bilateral relationship, as troublesome as it has been in, you know, in recent years. So, you know, sometimes these tectonic plates are shifting and they seem like they're, you know, a one-day story. Okay, Deng Xiaoping's visiting the United States. They're having cultural exchanges. And it's only decades later that you realize this changed the world. Carter believes that that will be his most lasting influence as president, is establishing the most significant bilateral relationship in the world.
My guest is Jonathan Alter. The name of the book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. We could take a week to discuss Egypt and Israel and the Camp David Accords, and a week to discuss Iran. So I'm going to try to boil it down to one or two questions about each. And I think from reading your description of what happened at Camp David, it really reads like a thriller. It's about to, the talks are about to end. The two sides are fighting. They're not talking. Jimmy Carter is literally physically running back and forth between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. By the time I finished that section, I thought, this section is about relationships and Jimmy Carter's relationships with these two men. He had a very close relationship with Sadat, not so as close with Begin. When was a moment when Carter's relationship with Menachem Begin had a real impact on the negotiations, for better or for worse?
So I think you're so right, Allison, that it's always about the human element. And Begin was being very difficult, and in part because he was giving up a lot. You know, giving up the Sinai, Israeli soldiers had died for what he was giving up. And it looked like the talks were finished and they were going to end in failure. On three prior occasions, one or the other side had packed their bags and gotten ready to leave. And it was Carter's persistence, his doggedness. Remember, no president had ever done this before, ever gotten down into the weeds this way. I had thought that Theodore Roosevelt had when he settled the Russo-Japanese War, but it turned out he actually never went to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where the talks were being held. Carter couldn't have Begin and Sadat in the same room at the same time, he found out after the second day of 13. So he had to shuttle between them. And it was really a virtuoso performance, but it seemed like it had ended in failure. And then his secretary, a woman named Susan Clow, was asked by somebody in the Israeli delegation to for some photographs. And she got the idea, why don't I have Carter inscribe these photographs to Begin's grandchildren and then have him walk the photographs over to Begin's cabin at Camp David. So Carter did that, and he got there, and Begin saw the photographs with the inscription, and he started thinking about his granddaughters, and he started crying. And that didn't, you know, end the problems right away, but it opened Begin's heart to one last try for peace. And so then in the 24 hours after that, they were able to come to an agreement. Begin retreated from the agreement after Camp David, and Carter had to go to the Middle East 6 months later and patch the whole thing together with chewing gum and masking tape. But they got it done. And it I think that human moment with the photographs tells you a lot about the way these things are often resolved. It does become a human thing. And in that sense, Carter is often asked why, as a former president, he talks to dictators, thugs, really terrible people. And he says, well, you have to look for something in them, some shred of humanity. And maybe if you can find it, you can stop the shooting. So it was always about stopping the shooting.
With Iran, after reading the section, again, it's very, very detailed. One of the takeaways I had was that Carter was failed by his people. His intelligence failed him, and the disagreements between Secretary of State Cy Vance, who leaned towards diplomacy and a peaceful approach, versus National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was more conflict adjacent, really caused problems. How was he failed by his people when it came to Iran?
Well, I think you're right that there was that disagreement, but it's also true that Carter, who was often criticized for his attention to detail. Oh, he's down in the weeds. He's so obsessed with detail. Well, on China, on the Middle East, on the Alaska Lands Bill, that attention to detail is actually what brought him success. And, tragically, he was distracted by a lot of other things that were going on at the time of the Iranian Revolution in early 1979, including the Middle East. And he didn't apply his normal obsession with detail to that crisis. So he was hurt by getting conflicting advice and not reconciling that advice into a coherent policy. But I think what really hurt him was, ironically enough, his humanity, because his instincts told him, don't let the Shah of Iran, the deposed Shah of Iran, into the United States for asylum. And he knew that something bad would happen if he did that. But then and he's getting all this pressure from Henry Kissinger and, all these pillars of the foreign policy establishment. David Rockefeller, they're all friends with the Shah, and they're telling him, let him in to the U.S. He was our ally, and we owe him this. And Carter's no. At one point, he actually says, F the Shah. But he didn't say F. Don't think he talks that way, right? But he did. So his instincts are telling him, don't let the Shah in. Bad things will happen. Then it comes out that the Shah has cancer. And then Rockefeller's people hoodwink Carter and the State Department into thinking that he cannot be treated in Mexico, where he was living at the time, and can only be treated in the United States. So on humanitarian grounds, he agrees to let the Shah of Iran into New York hospital, right? And so for a short time he's in the United States, then he goes to Panama. But in that short time that he's in the United States, within days after he's admitted to the United States, student radicals seize hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And that has a lot to do with destroying Jimmy Carter's presidency.
That was Jonathan Alter about his biography, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter: A Life.